the expression from the music inspired me so much to take risks, and it inspired damn near the whole rap game.
Hello again, I'm Adam Ons. You may know me as the host of The Opus, and now I'm bringing my own show, The Spark Parade, to the Consequence Podcast Network. I speak with artists and creatives about the cultural artifacts that spark their personal interest and creativity, whether it's music, books, movies, video games, or any other kind of art.
I've never spoke about it in this amount of detail. I'm suddenly going, oh my God, I'm blowing my own mind here, Christ. It's actually a giant part of my life.
By talking about the things we love, we share and discover insights into our personality and the things that drive us.
It's just magic, really. I mean, frustrating. And it makes some people angry, but I don't think anyone's ever done anything like it.
I speak with people like Connor Roberts, Phoenix's Thomas Mars, Chris Gethard, Helen Hong, Adrian Young, and more, so their sparks of inspiration can start a fire in you.
I'm grateful for those who continue to put our history and who we are as a people in the forefront and make you see it.
Find the Spark Parade wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
Do you read Stephen King? Good news. There's a club for you. The Losers Club. Every Friday, us losers journey through the never-ending wastelands of King's Dominion. We sink our teeth into each of King's novels, dive deep into the lore, and review every adaptation. Even better, we're always having guests over. Thomas Jane, Will Wheaton, Mary Lambert, Mick Garris, the list goes on. So what are you waiting for? Join us as we read on through long days and pleasant nights.
Consequence Podcast Network.
To all of you amazing pod people out there, I am your host, Leo Phillips, and this is another edition of This Must Be The Gig, your little backstage pass to the world of live music. Each and every week, I try my hardest to bring you a fascinating conversation from the beating heart of the performance world, and that could really mean chatting to a musician or a festival founder, a choreographer, a comedian, an actor, really anyone in the world who is obsessed with performance the way that we are. But before we dig into this week's fantastic interview and wonderful guest, which I am so humbled to have just even shared a moment with, let's check in first with our constant companion. I don't know why my voice went high-pitched. At TMBTG Studios, Engineer Adam. Hello!
Hey!
How are you doing this week?
I'm just here watching the boards to make sure that we don't have any Coachella-style sound issues.
Bazing!
Bazing!
Actually, Mark Hogan wrote an amazing essay on that. Go check it out.
But I'm also just here pumped up and inspired by our guest this week.
I know, me too. Let's get right into it. On today's show, we are joined by the one, the only Angelique Kidjo, the incredible singer and songwriter from Benin, was named Africa's premier diva by Time magazine. She's also one of Africa's 50 most iconic figures, according to the BBC, and one of the 100 most inspiring women in the world by The Guardian, among many other impressive accolades. And though our chat is focused mainly on music rather than politics, since her brand new album Celia is due out for release on April 19th, so just in a few days' time, on Universal and Verve, our conversation still really charged my soul. It felt like attending a protest or a peace rally. I feel like I just sat there with my eyes closed most of the time, afraid that if I opened it, something would stop, like the conversation would just end.
It really is a beautiful conversation, and Kid Joe has made major headlines in recent years, showcasing the shared musical roots across genres, cultures, traditions.
Yeah.
She put out a sublime record of Talking Heads covers last year called Remain in Light, performed as the soloist for Philip Glass's David Bowie indebted symphony, Lodger, and as you already pointed out, has an upcoming record inspired by salsa queen Celia Cruz. So she's really just spanning all over the world.
She is.
She's proud of her African heritage and the myriad musical roots it takes, whether that's in the shape of art rockers in Rhode Island or a Cuban national hero. And in this chat, you two talk about African identity and the ways in which her music is tied to it and the ways in which really all music is tied to it.
Of course we do. I couldn't help but corner a legend like her and get that insight because I feel like I've been screaming about it for so long.
Absolutely.
And having her talk about it just means it's that stamp of approval. Everybody's just got to listen to her and think she's completely right, which she is. And we also talk a lot about Angelique's journey from her first performances in Benin and fleeing political unrest to Paris, all the way to perhaps her most undeniably incredible work to date, the Batonga Foundation. She established this nonprofit in 2006 with the goal of empowering and educating adolescent girls in Africa. So girls who often are excluded from such opportunities. A champion of hope and talent in Africa, Angelique wants to make sure that African leaders and citizens work together to improve the lives of women and children. And the Batonga Foundation mentors, empowers, and trains women and girls in Benin to tap into their capacity and to be independent, to be powerful agents of positive change in their own lives and in their communities. And in fear of getting very teary, she really has started something that we all should be a part of, from female mentorship, life and financial literacy skills, and entrepreneurship training. Batonga is making a difference in so many lives, but then also in the communities at large as well. You know, you teach young girls how to be powerful and they can take over the world.
Usually this is the part of the intro where we ask you to write a review, to reach out to us. And while we would still love to hear from you on social media at TMBTGpod or to have a review on Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to podcasts, it'd be even more incredible if our listeners could donate to the Batonga Foundation. No matter how small, every dollar counts. And it's really incredible to know that $25, just $25, could send a disadvantaged girl to school for an entire year.
I mean, what is $25? It's like a salad in New York.
Absolutely,
you know?
It is.
$25 is a meal. And it, for $25 only, you could send a girl to school for one whole year. It's mind-blowing how much we can help. And even if it's not $25, even if it's $5, it's something. So divert your attention from reviewing us this week. I mean, give us a review if you want to.
Here's the idea.
But let's focus on the Batonga Foundation, and I'm just so proud to be aligning with them.
Here's the idea. Go to Batonga Foundation, BatongaFoundation.org. Donate $5, donate $25, whatever you can afford. Then leave us a review telling us you did it.
That you did it.
That's
let
a great,
us know.
That's partnership.
Show us your receipts. But let us not be delayed. This is me and Angelique Kidjo. Enjoy! Tell me a little bit about the stage invasion, because for listeners who haven't been able to see you live, I know obviously from seeing you and...
I just want to recreate that feeling of comforting when I was in Benin growing up, when the drum comes in and I got to catch up with people I haven't seen in a while, and being a kid just going around and dancing, and everything was permitted. I mean, you just feel free, you just run around, you do whatever you want to do, everybody got an eye on you and you have fun. I mean, it's a moment where we realize that, well, each of us have a life, but it's good to reconnect, to come back together, especially in this era of social network where people live in their bubble. I want people to realize that we got to live together. It's not a bubble that's going to save us from the reality of this world.
Mm.
And it's a celebration. It's a celebration. I just don't want also to be the type of artist that you see from far and you cannot come close to.
Mm.
If people don't come, you're nobody. And I think it's true that you have to protect yourself to a certain extent because there are some crazy people out there. But snubbing your public is dangerous because without them, there's no one. You're no one. You're nobody. You might be talented. If you're talented and you cannot touch people beyond your art and be there and they can see you and come close to you from time to time, then for me, it's I need people. I need people to tell me their story. I need to remind myself every day that I'm fortunate to be doing the job that I do. But that job is given to me, that talent of singing, it has been given to me for me to share and to bring people together, to empower people, to let people realize that each one of us have the power of transforming our world. It's not just the leaders of this country that have all the right. It's not because we vote for leaders in place that we cannot hold them accountable. And as an artist, I am the voice of voiceless. That's how they call me. But in a way, no one want to hear any African person talking about the beauty of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's so content and so satisfied by dehumanizing Africans, by diabolizing Africa. And everybody knows that without the resources of Africa, there's no economy in this world. So I want them to come close to me, then they can see that I'm just a human being equal to them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Not just this foreign thing, because I feel, you know, reading a lot of your interviews, I'm from South Africa. I don't live in South Africa anymore. I moved a few years ago.
I can hear in your accent. I know that.
Yeah. And, you know, when you are African, and I definitely associate as a South African before anything else.
Absolutely.
And when you are African, you feel like all your stories from your parents and your grandparents, everything was told to you, and you become a storyteller within your art. You never become this person that's closed off. It's all about family. It's all about life. And I love some things that I've read that you've said, or some interviews that I've watched you do. I love how you make a point about explaining in a really simple way, without sounding defensive. You explain what the African spirit is, how accessible it is, and where it comes from, and why it's so important, which is why I was so excited to get to talk to you, because there's so many misconceptions about Africa. You know, it's having this like cultural moment at the, you know, everybody's like, ooh, Africa. And like, the truth is, we've been around, you've been around, we've all been around, we've been here
it's
watching.
It's a constant battle. It's a constant battle.
Yeah.
And because, you know, I always say that it takes courage to leave.
I agree.
If you have the courage to leave, you have to be curious about other people and give them the chance to tell you who they are. But in our history has been hijacked by the people that came to Africa purposely to take our wealth. They knew from the get-go that they were going to commit a crime against humanity. And they already prepared the narrative that's going to exonerate them from being responsible for what is going on that continent. So they make clear to tell the story first and loud enough with false proof, with false facts, that today we are against a mountain that we can't basically climb, because they have the bottom of the mountain stopping us from telling the story.
Exactly. And they want to tell it for you. Yes.
Exactly. That's why each one of us, I always say to every African person that I met, I was at the airport in Frankfurt. I was in connection, and I met South Africans. They were waiting there to take the plane to leave. They work for South African Airways. And as a co-chair with Lufthansa, the treatment they receive in Germany versus the treatment we give the German people when they come to South Africa are two completely different stories.
Totally.
And I say, you cannot just sit here and take that abuse, because when they come to South Africa, we give them red carpet. So it has to be both ways, because we are not giving them, that it's not a charity business. They make lots of money coming to Africa. Most of those companies, airline companies, they make most of their money in Africa. So why should they treat us less, with less respect, when they're making more money from us?
Absolutely.
And if you don't speak up, I told those girls, if you don't speak up, I mean, poke the glass ceiling. Go to your to the people of South African Airways. Talk to them. If they don't want to do something, bring it to social network.
Mm.
Why should we always give to the people that come from the Western country a platform for them to walk on us and stop on us? And we can't say nothing.
Well, it's
that
because it's also because they feel like they can have they can tell the story better than we can, because either they think that none of us speak English, or none of us understand, or that we have lions in our back garden, or, you know, things that are the perceptions of Africans overseas. You know, they don't teach African studies. They just teach, you know, local. They teach what happens to their country. And then we have to learn all about the world, you know. And I think it's really frustrating.
It's true. You're completely right. It is frustrating, but it's coming back. It's coming back down to them today, because the reality check is coming up, and that's why we have so much crisis of identity in Europe. Because if you deny people the humanity, you endanger your own humanity, and that narrative cannot go on like that. If they don't want African people on their soil, they call themselves Christian. They have to. Christianity, God has created us different, thinking that we'd be smart enough to see the beauty in that differences. That what you have to bring on the table versus what the other person have to bring to the table can meet in a middle ground and create something more beautiful than hate that we're living in it. So if I said to this is my point on this populism and all this racism. Mm-hmm. I said, you want to keep your country for Westerner, okay, you have all right to think that. So then all of you leave Africa and their resources and find the resources on your soil to live the life you live in today. If you don't want the people from Africa, then you don't want our resources. You don't want our oil. You don't want our diamonds. You don't want anything that comes from our soil. Live by yourself. If you really want to be true to that, that's the way it goes. You got to have the guts and say to your people, okay, you want to be you want to be by yourself, okay. This is the deal. We're going to get poor. Are you ready for this? Because the Africans are the ones that are holding us up. I'm waiting for any of those populists from Salvini in Italy. Salvini said nobody comes in, but all that is coming from Libya has no visa. It's coming in every day. So the Italian people, Joanna said, we don't want Africans. Then don't take oil from us. Find oil in your soil. Everything you need for your industry, find it in your soil, and then leave us alone, and we stay home. We stay where we are, and we seek our resources. I don't want anybody to tell me that we are not smart enough to use our resources. We do whatever we want. We don't want to use it, it's our choice. We want to waste it, it's our choice. Just leave.
You left early on when you were very young. You left Benin, and you went to France, I believe. So how, because obviously feeling African, you can feel African anywhere. If it's in your blood, those roots are very strong, and knowing you can live anywhere in the world and still learn something and, you know, teach others about your roots, it's not a challenge. It's a privilege.
No, it's not. It's not. If you know where you come from, you can go anywhere.
Yeah, I love that. How was it to leave? Because it's been a while now, and obviously, do you live in the States now or do you live in Europe?
Yeah, I still live in the States.
Okay.
It's not easy.
No.
That's what I said to people all the time. People that said, why are you coming here? Why? I'm like, why is it that Westerner can go anywhere? You're going to see. I mean, if the words have power. You see? When we come somewhere, we are immigrants. When the Westerner goes somewhere else, they come to Africa, they're expected.
They're accepted, I know.
And I'm like, why is this a different story? I mean, you're moving from your country to establish yourself somewhere else. You're an immigrant, too.
Yeah, I'm an immigrant. I've always felt like an immigrant. I don't think I'll ever feel, you know, and I've worked so hard my whole life from the get-go. I don't think I'll ever feel like I'm part of anywhere other than South Africa, because that's the place that I was born and that's the only place that will really accept me, which is fine.
Yeah, but that's where your own, that's where your umbilical cord is. That's where all your being is. I mean, people don't understand that being from a place is not just a fashion. Everything about every atom in your body is linked to that place. And when you move somewhere, you move with that or that atom, your DNA everywhere you go, and you bring something to it. And it's really funny. I mean, it hit a journalist once. I was doing an interview in Switzerland, and the guy said, geez, I just realized that you coming in here, you enriching our culture. You come, because you come with a whole load of culture that is different from us, and really interesting for us to learn from. I said, thank you. But people don't think that.
No.
They're seeing you as a threat. A threat to what? What did anyone bring to this on this earth? It does not matter if you're white, black, yellow, red, if you're rich or poor. The day you die, there's nothing you're going to take. No one come out of the mom's womb with the hand filled up with gold or shackles. So we keep on forgetting those simple truths, that every single human being on this planet is African. So you be racist, you be hateful as much as you want, but that simple truth, you cannot run away from it. And that's the problem of the Westerner. They've lived in denial so much. They have told lies after lies about us for so long that they don't know where to start to detangle the truth from the lie.
And they continue, I think, also especially just from the side of, especially because you are a musician, you're an artist, you're an ambassador, and in your life, you know, people have told your story for you. So you do an interview and then people write your story, but it's very rare that those publications or those big places are giving the voice to maybe an artist or a journalist from Benin, or a journalist from Lagos, or South Africa, or even Windhoek. You know, it's very rare that they get given the chance to tell an African story. And it's exactly the same idea as the Latin community and having a Latina writer write about a Latina artist. They are going to write a much more worldly review, and they'll have an understanding that others won't. And I feel like I just don't understand. I think that's the whole thing, is that when I heard that I was going to talk to you, I think in my mind, I was just like, I've been trying to speak to you for so long, and I just don't understand. This is my only opportunity because this is my own show. You know, I had to create a show in order to be able to speak to the people that I know I can talk to.
Yeah.
I'm sure you feel the same way as an African artist traveling the world, and you've got these people asking you these really crazy questions, you know.
Oh,
and,
baby. You don't even want to know. I can write a book about the stupid questions. I can tell you that. Oh, my God.
I'm sure. Like,
on which planet are you living on? I mean, get out of your bubble, man. So ignorance is an insult to yourself. That's what I say to people. I say, I know more about you than you know about me.
I know, and that's what's so scary for them, I think, is that we grew up with American and Western music. You know, we grew up with that stuff. We know about it. But they haven't taken the time to learn about us by asking questions that really matter. You know, the ones that we would ask. You know, like when we meet people, you ask questions that talk to the heart.
Absolutely.
And that ignorance is so scary because you can't not get offended. So how have you been able to use it as an empowering moment and a teachable moment for others?
Yeah, but the thing, what happens to me sometimes is exactly what happened to you. When I arrived in France in 1983, one of the first stupid questions they asked me is like, how do you go about to buy your grocery on the back of an elephant?
No.
I'm like, you're in 1983 and you're asking me that. I said, you know what? Yes, of course. I sit on the back of an elephant to go to the market and I have a monkey on my head and my arm to go to get the stuff too. It's a constant schooling people. And I say to people sometimes, I'm so sorry for your ignorance. I have been forced to learn about you. And then I will get curious to know more about you. Whenever you guys take the time to want to know about who we are and what we are. And then every time you want to go to Africa, You said, I go to Africa, I went to South Africa. I said, but South Africa is beautiful, it's huge. But it's one part of Africa.
Mm, exactly.
You just put all the whole continent in one country. I'm like, people, get out of there.
And people only go there because the tourist industry is booming. So they, as you said, South Africa rolls out the red carpet. It isn't, South Africa is not Africa. You know, Benin is not Africa. Each country is totally different, has a different feeling, a different language.
But that's that's the complexity of my job.
Yes.
Because when I do an album, everybody say African, and then I say I'm from Benin, I'm from the continent of Africa, and the music in my country is different. That is the complexity the Westerner can't deal with, because the story has been told and simplified in the way that they never thought about Africa being a continent of 54 countries. And I say to people all the time, even the map of Africa, the way it has been drawn by the Westerner, is to diminish its importance.
Mm-hmm.
We can put America, and you can put the whole load of the rest of the planet in it, and we still have some room.
Yeah.
That's how big Africa is.
We still have some room.
And you look at me and go, really? I say, yeah, really. And I said to them sometimes, I'm so sorry for ignorance, your ignorance. I feel sorry for them because I'm like, one thing is they don't teach you in school. You become an adult. Do you have any curiosity to know about other people, or you just want to live in your life and just thinking that, okay, if I don't know about Africa, it's okay. Till Africa closed everything and then you can't eat anymore.
And I also think that it's obviously strange that then African artists, they have to have this responsibility weighing over them that everywhere they go, they know they're going to be called Afro-pop or Afro-funk or, you know, they're going to be Afro-jazz. They're going to be named something.
Afro-beats,
Afro-something, and they're going to be named this thing that they aren't. Why can't they just be an artist? Why do you need to put a label on it when you don't even understand the complexity of where those drums are coming from? Why does the drum, you know, why does it have that sound? Why do the strings sound different? Like, it's even just the format of a song made by a musician from Africa is completely different. We don't follow the same rules.
Yeah, but because the media are not made for us.
Mm.
The media are made for them to be telling. Everything is made for them to be telling the vast story about Africa. There's no room on prime time for any African artist because they say it's not sung in English. They keep on forgetting that the music that they have been listening to have come from Africa.
Exactly.
There's no one music on this planet that hasn't been impacted by Africa, all the way from pop music to classical music. You can call it any kind of name you want. There's Africa in every music you play.
And that's kind of why I got into this as well, and why, you know, people often, I've got to come up with challenges on my own, but I can't even imagine what kind of challenges you have, especially because you push the boundaries of what you make, of the songs that you make as well. You know your limitations, but you keep pushing through. And your music never feels political, but it feels politically timely. It just feels like there's a statement there, but you aren't. I know that you're not political and you're not politically charged.
No, I'm not a I don't want to do politics because I've been around politicians long enough to understand that they are cold-blooded killers. They don't have no, they have no empathy, no nothing. It's weird to watch them and to be in the midst. That's when you realize that you're better off being the musician that you are because you do more for people that they will ever do. That having said, I said that all the time, that if people don't want to learn about anything, the choices of ignorance, we choose it.
Mm.
There's a word in our vocabulary that I say is powerful and really important, is the word choice. The choices we made define who we are till we die. If you decide to be ignorant and hateful till you die, there's nothing I can say to change you. But if you said to me, sorry of my ignorance, I don't know, I want to learn, I will spend time and talk to you.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. You'll take any time.
Absolutely. There are some people that think that they are entitled to judge you. And I said, you have other issues in your life and don't make me the victim of your misery. I have nothing to do with your life. When you wake up in the morning, the choices you made, I have nothing to do with it. So therefore, live your life and let me live mine. And that's the main problem we have today with the social networks that give power to coward people to go after other people because they know you can't find them. There are so miserable and hateful and angry people around the world that they are coming out because internet gives them the right to be bullies and to be murderers. So the culture is something that can make us know better. That's why everything I do, my music is about building bridges because I know we have more in common than more that we think divided us. That I'm profoundly sure about that because every single human being on this planet, if when we wake up in the morning, we want to drink coffee or tea, we want to eat something before we leave. No matter where you are, we have to eat, we have to be healthy, and we have to go about and do what we have to do. From the moment we get up in from the bed, everywhere in the world, we have a purpose for that day. So if those fundamental things, good health, good education, good food, mingling, having friends, having problems, fixing it, falling and going back up, loving and losing the love, pain of love, if all of those things I'm saying is colorless, is human. So how can we sit and say that person is inferior to me when you go through the exact same battle every day?
So what were your biggest surprises then leaving Benin and, you know, getting into flee to Paris after the communist government kind of, forced your recording career into a corner? But what was the biggest surprise then of arriving in France?
Yeah, well, my first shock was the magnitude of ignorance of people about Africa. It's just breathtaking. And France has a very close tie with Africa. I mean, it's just that crazy. The economy of France basically lies in our money that is not our money. I mean, the French-speaking country have a currency that is linked to the euro. It's the same exact exchange rate. For the poor countries in Africa, it's hell to eat today. They will never, never let that go, because if they let it go, France will collapse. So will the eurozone will collapse. That's just the truth of it. But people are still ignorant, thinking that you come to their country to take away from them what they've worked hard for. And my question, people, is what did that take from you and what did you take from me? Let's get back and start thinking. Now, and I put it on the table. The facts are out there. You call yourself civilized people, that you came to Africa to civilize us. And all you do is just killing and taking. What makes you think that you can be superior to me when you have blood on your hands? Even if you dehumanize me, I'm still going to be a human being. Because you're committing crime to build your wealth that you call today your work. You don't work. All the raw material you need for your industry comes from Africa. So how can you tell me, coming from Africa, that I am an immigrant and I'm coming to take your job? You have been taking my life away since I was born. And growing up in Africa, it was obvious for me that the only way we can get out of this is to get rid of colonialism completely, which means we have to have our currency. We have to work with this African country, build infrastructure to link every country in Africa, take and then produce our good, our food. As long as we don't do that and we are not completely independent, now we have China coming up. Chinese, they are doing exactly the same thing as the British, as the French, the German, all of them, but they are doing it systematically to enslave us with the help of our leaders. Our leaders in Africa are our worst enemy for us as citizens. They are the ones selling our future short.
Absolutely.
They don't care about us. they are criminals that have to go. They gotta go.
They certainly don't care about women. I mean, that's also, you
know. They don't care about women. They don't care about anybody. But they care about the money. They care about the money that will enslave them too. Because China is dangerous.
So now you moved there in 1983. Had you performed a lot in Benin when you were younger? How did music come into your life so early? Where did it all begin?
My father said I start singing before I start talking.
Oh, really?
Because when my mother was pregnant, she wanted another girl. She had a girl before, but she had so many boys in between. And she said, God, just give me another girl right now. And I don't care how many boys come after. And one of my auntie was coming from the village for health issues in the city that would sing to the belly of my mother saying, don't worry, you don't have X-ray right now to see what is in there, but I can tell you she's going to be a girl and she's going to sing. So from what I heard from my parents, I was in the womb of my mom, I was always sung to. So I come out and start singing stuff I don't even know what existed. And my father and mother play music too. My father played the banjo, my mom played the clarinet.
Oh, wow.
But the passion of my mother was theater. So I started without asking myself any question about it. And then my brothers, they decided to have a musical band, and my father took a loan and bought the instrument for them. For the first time, I saw a drum, an organ, Farfisa organ, the amplifier for guitar, bass amplifier, a bass guitar. It was Alice in Wonderland when I came back from school in the middle of the boxes. I was like, what the hell is going on here? And I never questioned why I'm doing music. It was like breathing for me from day one. So when the communist regime arrived and they were forcing everybody to just do propaganda music, I refused, because my father always used to say, you can have a political opinion, but you cannot be linked to a political party, because they come and they go.
Mm.
If you want to have a career, stay away from that. So I did not want to do it, but it becomes such an issue that I was touring a lot. I did my first album in 1981, and it allowed me to tour in West Africa, to start a career in the region. And it becomes so clear one day to my mom and dad that I got to leave the country. Otherwise, I end up in jail or they end up in jail.
Why would you end up in jail? Just because of the government and how there was restriction on obviously being free and performing as you wanted to perform?
Yeah, but dictatorship don't give you the right to choose. You don't have the right to choose. I mean, at that period of time, even when you have to travel, you have to ask for authorization from the government. And you tell them where you're going, how long you're going, all that to keep your to hold your parents accountable if you don't come back. That's all it is. That's what it is. They create such an environment of fear and distrust that you don't trust even your father. You can't trust your mother. You can't trust anyone that comes home. It's something that is absolutely horrendous. And people today are playing with the idea of dictatorship. They don't know what it is. They do not know. People that have enjoyed freedom for so long, they don't know what dictatorship is about. Look at what is going on in China. When China opens up, people never ask themselves the question and go back in history. China is the only country where no one has penetrated their culture. No one has colonized them. And they watch the whole world. And they decide it's a moment where we got to open up for them to bring the technology and we can steal it from them and then we can conquer the world.
Mm.
And that's exactly what is going on. Chinese have their own set of rules. They don't care about anybody. They don't care about their own people. How many Chinese Mao Zedong have killed? And that was the dictatorship I was living under in Benin.
How did your parents then make sure that that spirit was not squashed by the government and that you were, you know, how did they instill that power in you to continue to be a singer and an artist?
They have always been supportive, always. My mom used to do my stage outfit. Yeah, my father would film my show, would give me 1 week of euphoria, and then the hell gonna go loose and everybody gonna go, that dress is not good. That song, it's not the right key. I mean, it was non-stop to to make me want to be the best ever, to question everything I do. It started home. My worst critics were my parents. Nobody else could be as hard as them.
Mm.
So, and when they see that I was struggling with this dictatorship thing, I have a brother that was student in Paris. He left from Togo. That's what he said to my parents. Yeah, you send her here. That's why I could leave. And if we didn't tell anybody we were preparing me leaving the country,
wow.
I just left.
Well, you couldn't tell anybody. They wouldn't allow you to just leave.
Oh, no. Oh, no, 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 no. Oh, no way. Oh, no.
Do you remember what things you took with you? Do you remember the things that you packed up?
I took very little.
Yeah.
I took a couple of clothes.
Wow.
And my book where I have a notepad with all the music that I'll put the lyrics. I write the lyrics for my concert. I don't even know where I put that notepad now. Notepad, I just throw it away.
Yeah.
And that's what all it is. And it was during the wedding of one of my cousins that we planned. We make sure that everybody knows that we are going to a wedding, because even your neighbors are spying on you. So I put my beautiful gown, into it in the plastic bag. I put the clothes I'm going to wear in the plane.
Wow. And how old were you when you left?
23.
Wow.
23.
And is your family still in Benin, or did they move as well?
My father passed away in 2008.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My mom is still alive. And I lost my bigger brother that used to do the music for me, with me. Mm. He passed away July last year.
Oh, gosh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, he came back from South Africa I sent him to South Africa for his prostate cancer.
Oh.
And he came back and it was too late.
Oh, I'm so sorry. It just happened last year. That's really painful to hear.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry that you went through that. Especially considering that you've got all of this, you know, all these stories and this weight and all these experiences on your shoulder, and then you're also expected to perform and do your best and make the best art. That's also really tricky. Yeah.
It is difficult. I was on tour. I was on tour when he passed away.
Oh, my gosh.
Only God knows how I put it up.
Oh.
I mean, it was so painful.
I'm sure. Why did you carry on? How did you carry on? I can't even imagine.
I couldn't tell you. If sitting down here looking back, it was too heavy for me.
Yes.
I was just doing what I had to do, because I know my brother was so perfectionist when it comes to music. Because he taught himself to play all of those instruments, guitar, bass, organ, all of those. He's a self-made man, musician. He went to Berklee College of Music here, and they wanted to keep him. But he said, my mom is still there, my kids, my family is there. He's the only one that still stay home. He rent his house to live with my mother when my father passed away. So for my mother, it's a huge void. He's no longer there. He's the person that come in the morning and say, how do you sleep? Is my brother. I mean, he's the backbone of all the, he becomes the head of the family community. It is just a lot.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I feel very teary. It's also difficult to also understand, I think, when people lose their family and they don't live close, and they don't realize how their brothers and their sisters become the head of the family. You know, when you lost your father, they don't realize how important that is and what that means when they leave.
He has to. My father was gone. He has to. He has no other choice. He was the firstborn of my mom.
How do you make sure then that you... Because I read in an amazing interview that you did that your mom once told you must be naked spiritually. You know, once you get on stage, you must leave all your issues in the dressing room. You must put your ego outside. What about your mom do you think of when you think of her now and think of all the confidence that she instilled in you? What do you feel about that?
She is the force to reckon with till today. I mean, she is a survivor. Because my mom is a single kid. She didn't know her father. The father died before she was born. She only had her mom for so long. We were everything for my mother. We were brothers, sisters. All she got was us. And she fought for us because she her mother-in-law didn't like her very much. And it was not easy for my mother, but she stays there. And she said, art is about the truth, the light in you that you let shine from time to time. And it doesn't matter how long you're on that stage. Just remember, you are not alone. You are with people watching you, and you are touching people's souls. In order for you to be able to do that, you've got to be completely vulnerable spiritually. You've got to be out there and giving everything you have. Sometimes you give more than you think you have. That everybody have an ego. You don't have to be an artist to have an ego. We all need an ego to stand every day next to other people, because some people are really have a personality that can overpower you. But you got to, but at the same time, you have to live also. You have to exist. You have to have a stake. But when it comes to stage, it's not about your ego. If your ego get on the way, then you stand up there looking at your belly button and looking at, and telling to yourself how great you are. Nobody moves that on stage.
Mm.
Everybody can stand up in front of the mirror every morning and do that shit. It's not what you're on stage for. So for me, it has been very clear since I was a kid that being on stage is like something sacred. For me, my stage is a sanctuary. Everybody is welcome as long as you don't bring on that stage violence and hate.
So when did you actually start touring? Do you remember your first ever performance that you had in Benin or even in France? Do you remember that first show that you ever did?
I remember in Benin, I was so scared. I was so scared. I was 6 years old. My mom shoveled me on that stage. I was like, hell no, I'm not going. She goes, yeah, you're going. And then people start laughing. I'm like, okay, the light, I have the spotlight in my face.
Mm.
And as long as I couldn't see the public, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to do my crazy stuff I do home. I was the clown of the house. I make everybody laugh.
Yes.
So I'm like, nobody's seen me. I'm going to do as I do home. And then when I start, I didn't even realize it was silent. And then I finished, and suddenly everybody stood up in a standing ovation. I was already gone. And my mom like, go back to the stage. People are clapping for you. I said, hell no, I ain't going nowhere. I'm out of here.
I'm out of here. Clowns. Totally. Do you feel that allowed you to approach performance and touring and making music in a way that maybe others didn't? It allowed you that strength almost because you didn't need to perform. It just was something that became natural to you.
I prefer to be on stage than to be in the studio, to tell you the truth. I hate studio. I can't stand it.
Oh, really?
I can't stand it.
Why?
Why am I going to be standing in front of that thing and singing to the wall? Like, yes. I don't want that. I really don't.
Yeah.
So I have to live up to that. I started my career on stage. So it was really important for me to continue that, to continue making people feel good about themselves on stage and also to have fun. Because if you want to entertain people, you got to have fun. If you don't have fun, you're bored. The people are going to go. So every time for me, it's a new show. I never take the public for granted. I always start from scratch. And the day it hits me, the words that my mom had been saying to the actors and actresses in her theater group, when you get to that stage, before you get to that stage, you have to be ready to be naked. The day I understood it, I stopped being afraid of going on stage. It stopped. Because I said, nothing can be wrong. Nothing bad can happen to me because I'm going to do what I was born to do. And that humility that comes with it gives you power.
And you obviously, you also explored different types of things that obviously affected you when you were younger, like your amazing cover. I can't even call it a cover album because it just has its own spirit. Listening to you sing songs from Remain in Light is just...
Yes.
There is something like when you say, look at these hands, you feel like you wrote it. It's, and as you can tell, this my podcast is called This Must Be the Gig, which is based off of This Must Be the Place, because I love Talking Heads as well. And I definitely understand how you connected to this African spirit of some of those songs.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what I told people when people were telling me, those words are absurd. I said, no, when you come from Africa, no words is absurd.
No.
Words are meaning beyond. Mm. You guys in the Western world, you just use words without thinking about it. I mean, we don't do that in Africa. I mean, everything, the tone you use to say something, you can offend somebody, does not even know you're offending the person.
Mm, exactly. I mean, yeah.
And people say, really? I say, yeah, really. I mean, words are important. It hurts more than anybody slapping your face.
Absolutely. But that's why self-reflection and honesty within African communities and African countries, it always feels much more like it is from your ancestry. It doesn't come straight from just you right now. It always feels deeper. I don't even know how to explain it. I wish I could explain it, but...
Me too. I wish I could explain it, because every time I'm not in Benin, I'm anywhere in Africa.
Mm.
You feel that kinship. It's something that we can't explain. It's just embedded in our soul, and we can't live without it. If somebody take it out of us, we're no longer a human being, let alone an African. I mean, it's just that. I don't know what it is. And people like, everywhere you go in Africa, you feel comfortable. I said yes, yes. Because we're all the same.
We're all the same.
It doesn't
matter
where we come. It's just like we Africans have to get our game together. It's not because you come from South Africa, I come from Benin, that we can't speak to each other. We have more in common than any other people on the planet. This is where it all started. And we have to embrace those differences to be able to be an example, an ideal, and a platform for people to understand that diversity is not a threat.
No.
It's a plus.
Exactly. That's thank you. That is what I say all the time, is that when I walk into a place where there's only one type of person, I feel incredibly unsafe. I don't feel comfortable.
It's eerie.
Yes,
it's eerie.
Thank you. Not an alien. It's like even traveling to Australia feels that way. Even traveling to, you know, parts of the States, some parts, and it's not their fault, you know, but I felt, and I am white, and I felt like, who's gonna attack me? I didn't feel like home, because in home you speak however many languages you want to speak so that you can talk to people next to you. You don't live. You know, obviously some places in South Africa, you do live in a bubble. You have to.
Yeah.
And that isn't right, which is exactly why I left. But there is so much about diversity that makes you feel like home. And that's why I live in Chicago. And many places in the States are similar, but Chicago feels diverse. I'm not ever hearing just English.
I discovered Chicago through my daughter, because when she graduated from Yale, she moved straight. Two or three weeks after she came back from Yale, she moved all her stuff to Chicago. She spent 4 years in Chicago.
Amazing.
I mean,
wow.
She's just like, she brought me to understand Chicago in a different way. And that's the thing, that when you have kids, they bring you to places. America, out of every other places, is weird. You come from one place to the other.
So weird. It's so strange. I know. And but you only experience that strangeness when you come here. You know, we all grew up with the movies and the books and the music.
Yeah.
And then you come here and you're like, what the hell is going on? Why? It's very, you're right. It's very strange. And there is a certain cultural difference between us and them. I mean, I'm sure when you are touring, you feel a difference between an American audience versus a European audience or an African audience.
Yeah. All the audiences are different. I mean, when I started touring in America, I didn't understand first why I was so uncomfortable in some places and comfortable in some places. And I realized the magnitude of this country. It's big.
So big.
It's done in a way that it's weirdly sick, that we cannot connect and relay on each other the same way. It's weird. And also, apart from the concerts I used to do, speaking engagement, since I wrote my book, And most of the time, I'll do it at university or women conferences or any conferences. And here I am speaking English.
Mm.
But you always have to adapt your language to the reality of the place where you are. And the last speaking engagement I had last year was in Jackson Hole in Wyoming.
Oh, God. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, shoot. Oh, shoot.
What was that? Oh, God. I'm too scared to ask how that was.
It was intense.
I'm sure.
It was intense because there was some high school young girl that came to that, and they asked to meet me after. And that's where it becomes really interesting. Out of the face of the public, they start confiding in me. And you have one young girl, 16 years old, stood up with tears falling down her cheeks.
Wow.
Saying to me, I'm afraid to live in this country. I'm like, oh, no, come on, sweetheart. Come on, come to my arms. No. What is going on? You cannot say that. You cannot. I don't want to hear that. She said every time she walked in the street, they said, go back to your country.
Wow. Where was she from?
She's American. This teacher was there. I said, let's come down. I mean, let's put every talk aside. We got to deal with this. Have you talked to anyone? She said, no. I said, now you talk to me, we got to poke this open.
Mm.
The teacher here have to talk to you about this. Your parents have to know this. You belong to this country. Even if your parents are immigrants in this country, you are born in this country, and you have every right to be able to walk tall in every street in this country. And what really I find out of that, they decided that they're going to come to my talk after reading my book.
Mm.
I'm like, how do you get that? And one of them said, after reading your book, I decided that the job I'm going to do is going to be a human rights lawyer.
Oh, wow. Did you ever expect that to happen, to have that effect on? Because I'm sure you feel so approachable. No. Did you? What are the kind of things that people tell you that they're inspired by? Because there's so many influences that you have. But, you know, you obviously were a UNICEF. You are a UNICEF ambassador, if I'm right.
Yep.
And you also run the Batonga Foundation, I would obviously love to hear more about, because I know that my listeners would love to hear more about that. But what kind of stories have you heard from people who have come up to you, and not only inspired by the work you do on a humanitarian level, but also from your art?
I don't know. Sometimes it it makes me want to cry. Sometimes I'm like, whoa, why are we living in such a disconnected world? I mean, the thing is, my music has brought me to meet amazing people around the world. I mean, I go to Australia every 2 years, and I still see the same people that welcomed me when I get there in the 90s, early 90s. It's the only place on this planet, apart from my hometown, and I walked in, get out of the plane, and you have people I don't know from nowhere with banners saying, welcome, Anjali Teacher.
Oh, wow.
I was like, what?
In Australia?
What in the world is this? I've had people come to me and tell me different type of story. A lady in Houston, I invited people on stage as I used to do. She started dancing, and then at one point, she was at the corner of the stage and sobbing, crying. So I went to her. I was like, are you hurt? Something's wrong? What is it? And then she said to me on stage that if anyone would have told her that she would come to this stage and see me and be alive, she would say, this is a lie. Because she was diagnosed with final breast cancer.
Oh.
And her sister or friends brought her my album. And she said, you were the only voice that would get me out of my treatment, that get me up from that place where I'm flirting with death. And the voice was telling me, no, you can't go there. And she hung on to that music. She fought. And the doctor said, they don't have any words how she made it out here.
Wow.
But she knew that it was my music that brought her back from the dead to the living.
But how important is it then for you to continue to travel? Is that why also just with, you know, having to go through so many hardships in your life, is that why you continue to do it?
I believe that if you are a human being that has some privilege given to you by nature, it comes with a duty. It comes with responsibility. It's up to you to choose to do something about it or not. And I decided from the get-go, because I was born like that. My parents were desperate for me. I would fight for other people. Every physical fight I've been involved in elementary school or high school was fighting for other people's rights. And my father was always used to say to me, don't get into physical fight because you lose the battle. Use your brain. It's your ultimate weapon. And I start understanding that, and I start thinking before acting. And my mom and dad have helped beyond any other people I've known. With one paycheck, not only my father was able to send 10 kids to school, but beyond those 10 kids, any child that was dropped in that house, my father said, you ain't gonna sit in my house not going to school. Even if you have to stretch and you have to eat the same food for days and months, you go to school. So that's where I come from. If I can do something to better somebody's life and I'm there and I don't do it, I can't live with myself. I just can't. So for me, starting Batonga Foundation, it all started with primary education. That when I was appointed UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador in 2002, it was it coincided with the Millennium Development Goal, where every child had to have access to primary education. So I recorded a lot of PSA for radio, TV, in many different languages, urging parents to send their kids to school. And we have enrollment beyond our expectations. And the school were not ready for that amount of people. So you have rotated school. And one or two years into that, I was in Tanzania with UNICEF with something completely different. And I've been approached by mothers that came to me and said, we know you, we know your music, we know what you stand for. We put our girl to primary education.
Wow.
And we just have to remind you that if those girls finish primary education and they don't go to secondary education, they're going to end up in early marriage, like
exactly.
us.
Exactly, yeah.
And one of the reasons we choose this opportunity to send them to primary education with your messages is because we hope that they can go to secondary education. What are we going to do about it? That's when I start thinking about secondary education. And when I started in 2006, people from that know a bit about education were telling me, why are you going to do that? You're going to fail because the dropout in secondary education is higher than anything else. And I said, my reply at that time was, if it's easy, why bother? We need to reach out to those girls, because the idea that our kids going to be sleeping in the bed of 50-year-old men is not a tradition, it's a rape. I refuse that.
Exactly.
So I started Batonga Foundation in 2006. And my first mandate was to give them scholarship, uniform, books, tutoring, mentoring, 1 meal a day in 5 different countries, Benin, Mali, Cameroon, Ethiopia, and Sierra Leone. In Sierra Leone, in Waterloo, where we are, the second city, we built the school from scratch.
Wow.
It was successful because one of the things that was really clear for me, I said, I would do this only if we work with local NGOs that knows the girl. I don't want to be in the cities. I want to reach out to the poorest of the poorest, the one that have the brain that don't have the means to go to school. That was my mandate from the beginning. So the mentors were made of men and women at the beginning, and they were my voice, my ears, and the interface between the family and the school. And I worked with local NGOs such as Save the Children, Mercy Corps, World Education. All those people, we worked together because I believe in putting together resources from the get-go to have a better and a long-lasting result.
Absolutely.
So it happens to be that the girls in Kidal, in the northern part of Mali, were the first ones to drop out out of the radar because of the terrorists. I never have any news from those girls, and no, not one bit of people from the UN can get in there and get me any information. And that was heartbreaking for me, because those girls from the get-go, every year they send me their grade, they send me letters and telling and thanking me for allowing them to become something else, but white. In Ethiopia, for example, we work in Addis Ababa with Save the Children, and in the southern part, in Abamech, we work with Mercy Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And what we realized in the southern part of Ethiopia is that instead of giving the scholarship to the girls, we give that scholarship as a loan to the mother. And in return, she paid the scholarship. It was a success. Because what that does is that it reinstalls the mother in her role of parent.
Mm.
What we have to be careful about is not to unbalance completely. We can have a girl going to school that is educated and start not respecting the mother because she thinks that she's better than the mother.
Absolutely, exactly. And have that imbalance. Yeah.
Exactly. So after almost 10 years, now I want to, my focus now is reaching out. We stopped the scholarship program and I start working with Population Council because the rate of dropout, I want to understand it and how we can salvage those girls.
Mm.
And they have a technology called Girl Roster that they use in Guatemala that works. That cell phone has database in it where you can map a community of 5,000 people a day.
Wow.
And you collect all those information. And when you come back to your computer, you plug the phone on your computer, you have a map of the situation of the community and the girls. So what comes out of that first mapping in 2016? The girl, first of all, they needed a place, a safe place. We create what we call girls' club for them to be able to meet together at a place where they feel safe, where they can learn and start a business. And also what we learn is the girl, are they living alone when they drop out of school? Are they married? Do they have children? Are they about to be married?
Yes, what and is the what reason? Is yeah.
What the reason and how we can give them an activity-based income. They come up with their own business plan. And I'm telling you, we started with 60 clubs. Now we double that, and the number of kids are growing.
Wow.
And what happened, and that is really making me always coming to tears, is that those girls, when I started with them, you ask them, what is your name? They won't talk. Today, they come up. And they tell you exactly what it is.
Mm.
And they say, they don't want this anymore. And the mentors, I changed the recruitment of mentor, and now I want only women.
Good.
From 25 to 40 years old. I want them to be there for the girl. And the mandate they have is, let them be free to speak up freely.
Mm-hmm.
No religious brainwash. Mm-hmm. No traditional brainwash. You're going to be there for the well-being. Whatever they need, that's what they're going to have. And it's absolutely amazing because right now what we are doing is reducing the gap of gender inequality. Those girls are so powerful. And what I insisted also, because in that endeavor, MasterCard Foundation has helped me. And if you go on the MasterCard Foundation website, you'll see the work that we do and the report of it. Now I ask them, instead of 12, from 12 years old to 20, I want to go down. I want younger, from 10 to 12.
Mm.
So we start, and I meet those little girls. I mean, some of them are already suffering hell, but they won't say. But suddenly you see that you can see that they know that I can become somebody else, but not just a bride.
So what do you need? So for people listening now who feel like they don't do enough or feel like they don't know what to do, what is a call to action right now? What could they do for your foundation and for the work that you do? How can they help?
They can go on the website and engage any way they want. It's not only money that we need. We also need, because what I realized, in order for them to be, those girls to be successful, we need a different curriculum than what is going on.
Mm.
Because I realize that putting them to school only, the teachers are not good, so they fail. So if they can go to a school with good teachers, we need people with life skills to teach them how to run their business. And the mother told me December, last December I was there, she came to me and said, thank you for doing this because the rate of child marriage has decreased. And
wow,
most importantly for me as a mother, the rate of abortion has disappeared.
My friend started a rape crisis center called Nonseba in South Africa, in Cape Town, in one of the townships, and it's there. She built it, and obviously the rape statistics in Africa, in South Africa, are extraordinary. You don't ever want to look at them.
Oh my God.
Because they are so high that you feel sick to your stomach that this is happening continuously, and it's not stopping. It's slowing down, but it's not stopping. So thanks for obviously.
We got to work. We need, as I said, not only we need women, we need men also on this issue.
Exactly.
Because in our legislation, rape is a crime. But how can we implement that into action when at the head of the country, you have leaders that rape women?
Yeah. Having your new album, which is so incredible. You have a new album coming out inspired by a musician, the queen of salsa. And that's obviously amazing to expose the world to the African roots of so many different musical traditions. But is this something, especially coming from Remain in the Light, and you know, you've obviously, you've done so much within the last few years. Do you feel like this is something... You know, you were also named Jazz Master by Harvard University, all these accolades. What do you feel you have left to do? Because your songs are always imbued with so much emotion. It's you can feel every single note and every single sound through it. Is there something that you feel like you haven't done yet, that you still, or a place maybe in the world that you haven't gone, that you want to visit?
There are so many places I wanted to go. There's so much stuff I want to do. And for me, it's all about inspiration. I mean, Celia Cruz has been, for me, the woman that made me realize that salsa is not only a man business. Because most of the salsa band I made is male. And when she came in, it was a slap in the face. A good slap in the face. She's a strong woman. She has been going through all those cliches about Black people. Black people knows, Black people lives. And she, the persona she created for herself is that, I don't care what you say. I'm me 24/7. I will put red lipstick on. I'm going to put any kind of wig on. I can put any crazy outfit, any crazy shoes, but I'm me. That's what I want the young generation to realize, that you don't have to fit into a standard. Be you, be different, but don't copy at the risk of your life. Celia Cruz was generous. She was powerful. She was joyful. One of the things that really strikes me is the joy, the pleasure she exudes when she's on stage.
Mm.
And today, we have darkness filling up every space. I want to bring light. I want to bring joy to every darkness. For each one of us to know that it's not that some people want us to feel powerless, that we have to give them our life without fighting back.
But we're going to fight. I feel like also, especially considering how much you've been able to do, you know, over these years. You also, a couple of months ago, I read that you performed as the soloist for the world premiere of Philip Glass's Symphony No. 12 alongside LA's Philharmonic Orchestra. What was it like being involved in that? And how do you feel? Because it feels like it's not quick between the times, but, you know, you're inspired by Celia and David Byrne and Talking Heads and working alongside Philip Glass, all these incredible people that you are inspired and influenced by. How do you, what does it feel like to be involved in all of that?
Well, Philip Glass put me in the middle of this without asking me first.
Okay.
He called me and said, okay, Angelique, well, okay, they asked me for the 100 years of Ella Field to work on the last trilogy of David Bowie in Berlin. So he already did Law and Heroes before. And then they tell him, why don't you complete that trilogy by doing Lodger? And then he said to them, well, I listen to it. I don't like the music much. But they said, please do something. Then he said, he came back and listened to it, and he said, okay, if I do this, I would do it only at the condition that Angelique would be the soloist, because she's the only person that can do it. And then he called me up and said that. I said, okay, Philippe, already you put my name out there. I can't say no to this. So it took me another months to learn all this. But it's fun because you discover David Bowie as a poet.
Mm.
His poetry is beautiful. I mean, it's amazing. We don't know that from him. And the subject on the song Lodger are absolutely amazing.
Mm.
We were talking about traveling around the world when he arrived in Kenya, because he went to Kenya with his son.
Yes.
When he arrived in Africa, he's just talking about all the cliches that he had in his mind that doesn't fit the reality. At least he was honest enough to talk about it. He was talking about women abuse in those. And when he wrote the song, Johnny is a man and he's bigger than her, I guess the bruises won't show if she wears long sleeves.
Mm.
I mean, but the space in her eyes shows through. That is the thing that I love to sing because it's so accurate. So when I saw all this, and I'm like, Philippe, I'm doing it. There's no way I say no to this because it's just who I am.
Absolutely, especially because it was the last of the trilogy, and there's so, if you just even look at the title, I don't know the sequence of it offhand, but I know that like African Night Flight is like number 4. You know, he already puts you in the
African
moment.
African Nightmare. One time more, moment for Inula Balumen. I know that.
Oh, love that. And voice keeps swinging, and oh my gosh, Look Back in Anger as well.
Boys keep swinging. Boys always work it out.
Oh God, I love it.
I love it.
But so going from that and performing there, and then you have your upcoming tour. Obviously, you'll tour with various projects throughout the year. And I know that you're going to be opening up for Vampire Weekend at Madison Square Garden on September 6th. And...
Mm-hmm.
That's a band, I suppose, who's always leaned really heavily on African music traditions. But I was curious what you thought of particularly, you know, American, but particularly white American bands utilizing African music cues. Because obviously that's something that Talking Heads did to great acclaim, but also something that Vampire Weekend has gotten a lot of pushback from. All about appropriation and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, well, you know what? People cannot push back on that. Where does the blues come from? Ah, if you like the blues, you have been listening to African music from the moment you start. Jazz, where it come from? Bebop, where does it come from? Hip hop, where does it come from? Country music, where does it come from? I mean, excuse me.
Do you feel like, obviously, because how did that, I think in my mind, I'm like, how did that opportunity come about? Because, you know, what do you think of a band like that making a lot of money and getting attention on African traditions? The way that Talking Heads put within their albums, they put information, you know, they were never there to copy, as you said earlier. It was always an interpretation. So do you feel like opening for somebody like Vampire Weekend in a year like 2019, you feel very confident about? That's something that you're excited about.
Absolutely. I mean, the first time I met the Vampire Weekend band, I was an MC among the MC of Peter Gabriel's Foundation Weakness.
Mm-hmm.
So I was about to introduce them. And I walked in, and I didn't know who they were. They go, Angelique Kidjo, we love this song, and we love. I'm like, looking at those white dudes, you know my song?
Yeah.
And I'm like, ooh, I feel stupid right now. Who are you? They say Vampire Weekend, and I'm like, I'm gonna listen. I'm gonna check you guys out. They say one day you're gonna come, we're gonna do Malaika together on stage. I said no problem, and we became friends from that moment on. I've been working with Ezra Cunning, the singer,
mm-hmm. He's wonderful.
For years. I mean, mm-hmm. I've known Ezra for the last, I would say, pretty much 10 years. And he's an interesting dude when it comes to music. Because what he told me, he grew up, his parents, most of those kids, white kids, as you said, they were listening to the music of Africa. They were listening to King Soniade, all those music from Africa, all of them. Miriam Makeba, Hugh Masekela, all of them.
Oh, my favorite. I love Miriam Makeba so much.
He grew up listening to all those music.
Mm.
So how are you going to tell a child that have had progressive parents that teach them to think outside of the box, to listen to other music, that they can't do what they learned, what they heard? It's like me, I can't touch any music because I learned that when I was a kid. What works for me has to work for the other guys too. So that's where everything stands. We cannot say we have to open our children to the world and not allow them to express that world the way they wanted to.
Absolutely. And also especially because you are also inspired by them equally, and you know how talented he is, and you know that their heart is in the right place. You know, obviously appropriation, that whole conversation is sometimes so difficult to have because it's also tokenizing the word appropriation, which I think is just a blanket term for excusing people's behavior. And obviously, if you're inspired and influenced and you know the history and that's it's authentic and you've brought up with it, you know, you were brought up with it, it's very difficult to say that you're not allowed to do something, that part and pocket of art is not reserved for you. And it's really hard to see, you know, people commenting on that.
As long as you recognize the source of your inspiration, it's okay. Music have only 12 notes. And those 12 notes have created, among everything, amazing piece of art. Music is the only form of art that brings people together. Somebody sent me the video of the Pope in Morocco with the orchestra allowing Muslim, Jewish, and Christian singing the cantics of God in their languages. The only form of art that can make that happen is that. Suddenly you see that we've been fighting on the name of God, killing people on the name of God. There's only one God, damn it. There's only one. So I don't care who wants to instrumentalize God. We've made God a monster because we don't have the courage of facing our own weakness, our own thirst of blood. God sent no one here to kill anyone. Zero. It's our choices. Let him out of our misery.
So if you could not play God, but if you could play like as though you ruled the universe and you had the power to, say, build a festival and a music experience to your liking, what would it look like? Where would that music concert be, and who would perform?
Everybody. It would be days and days. Yeah. I would do a festival. We're going to start with traditional music from all around the world, one after the other. So around the world. It's going to be the whole year. And they have to meet. It's not just playing and leave. There has to be conversation. They come together and create piece of art from there. Doesn't matter what language, doesn't matter the skin color. We're going to start from the foundation of what music is. And we can finish it with classical music or we can finish with hip hop. It doesn't matter. If I have to do that, that's what I'm going to do. Throughout the years, that all of us, musicians and artists, painting will follow that.
You've got a lot of different upcoming shows. You've got in North Carolina, you've got in New Jersey, you've got in London, Paris, Luxembourg. Gosh, I'm just looking at the list. You've got, then you come back to the States and then you'll be in New York by September. Is there a venue that you love playing? Especially considering how you'll be doing Celia and Remain in Light at certain different shows.
I like the public to be close to me. I've always liked that.
Amazing.
I love Carnegie Hall. I love Royal Albert Hall. I love Sydney House, Opera House. I love places where the sound is so good that you don't have to do any effort to sing.
I know, obviously, you saw Celia perform when you were younger, but is there a performance or a concert that you saw that really changed the way that you felt about music and performance?
Celia was the first one, and Miriam Makeba, of course.
Ah, where did you see her?
I did. I opened for Miriam Makeba in Paris in 1989.
Oh my gosh! And I didn't know that.
I was such a fan. She means the world to me. When I was being asked to sing to open for her, I pinched myself days and days in before it started, and I was so excited. I get sick the next day. I mean, I could not believe I was gonna be in the presence of Miriam. She came when I was doing my sound check, and she listened to, and then with that soft voice, said, "Go ahead, my girl." I'm like, "Oh my God, I'm gonna die." Miriam Makeba songs, they seem easy, but when you start singing them, it's a different story.
Like, what song in particular are you thinking about?
All of them. All of them. If you can't sing from your gut, don't touch Miriam.
Oh, I love everything about her. There's so, I just thinking about her now, I listen to her at least once a week if I can. It's just what I was brought up with.
Yep.
And I think that, especially because, like, on some of our advertisements even, you had the Click song. Or, you know, you had Soweto Blues and from Mwelela. You know, you had so many of those songs just playing in the shops, you know, in 7-Eleven or wherever you walked into a store.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. So you performed for her, and then did you get to watch her after you opened for her?
Yeah, and then I come to know Miriam. I mean, we've done some festivals together. She gave me a lot of advice on being, because before I go on stage with my watch, and she said, "No, you can't go walk on that stage with the watch. Because if you have a watch, you have the tendency of wanting to look at the time."
Yes. Oh, when gosh.
Stage,
okay.
You don't look at the time.
What else did she give you advice about? That's incredible. I didn't know that. What else did she tell you?
She was mad about the word world music. And she said, "Angelique, as long as they try to label us, refuse every label because you're a human being. There's no label for human beings."
And that's still going on now. Can I tell you, the other day I went into a record store here, and guess where Miriam Makeba's record was? The world music section.
Yeah.
It makes me crazy.
Yeah.
So if somebody had never heard your music before, if somebody from the future literally came and was like, "What do you do for a living? Tell me about your heart. What does it look like?" How would you even begin to describe it?
Oh, you know what? That question had been put to me. And I said to people, "I don't know. How do you breathe?"
Oh my God, I have to clap. That's amazing.
I mean, people ask me questions. I'm like, "Are you breathing?" When you ask me that question, how do you breathe? We all have to breathe. If you don't breathe, you die.
Do you feel like there's something that you want people to know about you that maybe there's a misconception about you? Do you feel like there's something that...
Oh, yeah. People sometimes say, "Angelique is always angry." I'm not angry.
No.
I am passionate.
Exactly.
And I cannot... saying the waste of life, the waste of talent, when people decide who you have to be. Who gives you the right to tell anyone what they have to be? Do you know what you're going to be yourself? And let alone telling people what they got to do. I am against injustice. I'm about empowering people and giving people the choice to make their own mistakes.
Mm.
It's okay to fail. You don't fail, you don't know success. Success is just a matter of failure. So here we are living in a society where everybody want to be politically correct. This has to be like that. It's not possible. We are not perfect, nor do nature. What have you seen in nature that is perfect? Even a tree, the leaves are not the same length. Nothing about nature is perfect. Why should we be perfect? Who are we to spend so much time and energy judging people? You don't want to be judged, don't judge somebody. If you don't want somebody to throw a stone at you, don't start throwing the stone. If you don't want somebody to hurt you, don't hurt people. What you don't like anyone to do to you, don't do to other people. And we keep on forgetting those simple principles. And then when I'm talking about it, I get passionate. I'm not angry. I just want you to remember and to realize that if you don't take a step back and think about it, something happens to you that day and another day, you can't blame anybody for that because you haven't given somebody the chance to be to be who they want to be.
And also calling somebody angry or aggressive when the words are not angry or aggressive, it's the tone and your delivery that's passionate because of your life and things that have happened in your life. And people
can't... But I realize that...
Yeah.
But one of the things that I realized is that people don't like passion.
Of course they don't. It scares them.
If you're a passionate person, you put people out on ease. Because people just want to go to the surface of things. And when you push them to open up, they don't want to go there because they never open up themselves to understand who they are, really. And my passion, I can't quench down to please people. If I'm mad, I tell you I'm mad. Right now, I'm not being passionate. I'll tell you straightforward. I am mad because what you did is not right. That's why I'm mad. I'm not mad at you. I'm mad at the situation.
At the situation, exactly.
Because you did something wrong. If you do something wrong, just apologize. I grew up in a household where my father said to us, I don't want to deal with guilt. Guilt is out of this house. Guilt will make you an afraid person. You're going to be afraid of your own shadow. You do something wrong, apologize and move on.
And especially hearing that when you're so young, it's so complex and nuanced, that idea of bringing everything to the forefront. The way that I was raised and grew up, my parents said, you say something. If you have an issue, you put your hand up and you say something. You never do it with aggression, but you speak out. And I feel like people are very afraid of that, because not only does it make them reflect on themselves, but it makes you seem obviously unfamiliar. Maybe they disconnect from that feeling. Maybe they feel like they can't do enough. And you are basically holding up a mirror, you know, and it's hard to find. It's hard to listen to that. But I'm so proud that we live in an age that you are at the forefront of your career. You have accomplished so much and people have taken notice.
I always say, if you're not ready to have a kid, please don't have any. Same with pets. You don't like pets or you don't have time for them, don't have them. So when I was growing up, my father always consistently saying, if you don't speak up, I can't read your brain. I can't help you if you have a problem. If you don't speak up, I won't tell you I have all the answers, because I can't answer to all the questions. I will help you find your answer. I will walk you through it for you to find out where did you make a mistake. And from that point on, you learn. And when the situation occurs again, you know where you draw your boundaries. That's where I come from. I never blame anyone for my actions. Never. I have no shame to say, I'm sorry.
Take accountability.
I apologize to you. I feel horrible about myself right now, about what I say or what I do. You don't want to accept my apology, I can't force you to. But at least I've said so. Accepting apologies is also a matter of humility. People that don't accept apologies because they want to feel offended and hold you accountable and hold you by guilt, they have other issues. I'm not going to talk to you ever again. I'm moving on.
It's a protective thing. It's like a protective spell that people... Self-protection is really dangerous when people just choose to either escape it or just don't address issues, or they don't want to hear what's wrong with them and they don't want to move on and build and grow. It's really difficult, especially in you know, some of the things that you sing about and you know, your music and how you tackle that. you come mm-hmm. front and face into people's faces with things that they need to question about themselves.
But we don't do that often.
No, we don't.
We don't do that. We are always running away from ourselves. Because when you take the time and you sit down and you look at yourself in the mirror, sometimes it's not pretty. But it's absolutely compulsory to do it for you to keep your humanity, to be able to see the humanity of others.
And just check yourself.
It checks yourself first and foremost. When you ask me, what can I do to help in Africa? I said, first of all, the question, the way you put it, is wrong. We cannot be your charity. Certainly where you come from, there are people that need help in your community. Start in your community. You cannot help people if you're not able to help the people
around
that you,
you
live with. If you don't see the reality of the racism or the segregation of where you live in, if you lose the ability to be able to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and you feel entitled to everything and the other person not having any rights, then you have a problem with yourself. Because when you're going to need help, the problem that you, the person that you disenfranchised, the person that you have taken everything away from, that person will might be the person that will save your butt. What are you going to do then? You're going to think that you're entitled to that help and walk away without saying thank you? One day life going to slap you in the face. I always say it. Action call for reaction. If you do not do anything and you just walk your way through this life, taking and taking and taking and knocking people down, one day life gonna say stop. You're gonna hit a wall so bad that when you get up, you look left and right, no one will be there to help you. And you only have yourself to blame.
And I feel like African music and music that comes from Africa, the basis is all about collaboration and being together and bringing that spirit. You know, it's all about being together and making sure that you're working as a collective as opposed to just operating. Is it that there's that old African proverb that I always think about, which is, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And that's exactly what...
Yeah.
That's exactly what you're saying.
It is too.
This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kibble, and we'd like to thank Billy Yost and The Kickback for our theme song, Rube, and buy their music at thekickbackband.com. Lexi Frame for the artwork, Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the additional sound design, and the Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a bunch of other amazing shows. Hey! If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us, and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod. And generally, just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again, and I miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.